From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Millions of dollars are now being poured into efforts to take private money out of campaigns. We look at the new clean money movement, but also at what it means for foundations to push grassroots groups to change direction and focus on campaign finance reform. Then, amid the high-tech, big-money election campaigns of today, we hear about some old-style ballot rigging in West Virginia.
And we looked at, there may have been 400-some voters in that particular precinct, and it was like 30 may have voted. It was incredible. And we started asking around, and we heard that they were paid to stay home.
Meet coal miner's daughter and former Democratic gubernatorial candidate of West Virginia, Charlotte Pritt. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The McVeigh jury heard testimony from the prosecution's star witness yesterday. As his wife did earlier in the trial, Michael Fortier said the Oklahoma City bombing defendant told him of his plans for the attack months beforehand. In fact, he said his old army buddy took him to see the federal building he wanted to blow up to avenge Waco and spark a general uprising in America. Fortier said Timothy McVeigh was so intent on those goals that he considered using his truck bomb in a suicide attack. Ruling in an important voting rights case, the Supreme Court yesterday curbed the Justice Department's ability to insist on greater representation of minority voters as the price for approving redistricting plans. The court's 7-2 ruling applied to the provision of the Voting Rights Act that requires 9 southern states and parts of several other states to obtain permission before putting any voting changes like redistricting plans into effect. This news from Detroit. General Motors Corporation's labor troubles escalated into a third strike early today as more than 8,200 workers walked off the job at the automaker's electrical wiring harness factories in Warren, Ohio. The strike could force GM, already battling walkouts at assembly plants in Michigan and Oklahoma, to shut down much of its North American operations if it drags on for a lengthy period. The Delphi Packard Electric Systems plants produce wiring harnesses and wiring harness components used in most of GM's North American-built cars and trucks. The harnesses deliver electrical power and signals throughout the vehicle. The Washington Post is reporting today the Central Intelligence Agency is considering a plan that would bar its top officials from working for any foreign government or political party for 3 years after retirement. The newspaper quoted from a proposed CIA regulation nearing final approval, which, if adopted, would be the first of its kind for any U.S. agency involved in foreign relations. South African President Nelson Mandela and his deputy Thabo Mbeki are pulling out the stops to pursue their Zaire peace initiative and ensure a shipboard summit goes ahead tomorrow. Presidential spokesperson Parks Makahelna said Mandela was scheduled to chair the second face-to-face meeting between President Mobutu Sese Seko and his rival Laurent Kabila aboard the South African Navy icebreaker in the Congo port of Pointe Noire at 11 on tomorrow morning. Japan fired its ambassador to Peru today, forcing him out over security lapses that allowed rebels to storm his residence and take hundreds hostage. And finally, this weekend I went down to Knoxville, Tennessee, and the front page of the Knoxville News Sentinel reported this. It says Lamar Alexander, like several politicians from both parties, is using an increasingly popular fundraising device to avoid federal limits on campaign donations. Known as a leadership PAC, it's a spreading practice which the investigative committee of Tennessee's U.S. Senator Fred Thompson likely will look at. A leading proponent of campaign finance reform, Senator John McCain, the Republican of Arizona, said in an interview that the use of leadership PACs to circumvent federal campaign limits is another argument for campaign finance reform. Leadership PACs are used by people like Alexander, former Vice President Dan Quayle, and Senate Majority Leader Trent Lott to finance other races and build their respective political bases. What's coming under increasing scrutiny in both parties is the practice of transferring money between the state and federal PACs of parties and candidates. And you're listening to Democracy Now! Well, lawmakers in Washington talk about the need for campaign finance reform. In fact, they talk a lot, but that's about it. The Senate has had 29 hearings, 522 witnesses, 17 filibusters, and 113 votes on the issue of campaign fundraising in the last 10 years. Amid the inaction in Washington, a grassroots movement for campaign finance reform has emerged around the country. As we've been reporting here on Democracy Now! For the last year, groups are fighting for and in some cases winning new regulations that outlaw private donations to election campaigns. Instead of private special interest money, campaign reform advocates are calling for public financing of elections both on a state and federal level. In recent months, this movement has been spurred by the infusion of some $9 million in funding from large foundations, but it's a development that has some activists worried. This past weekend, I went down to the Highlander Center in eastern Tennessee for a Southeast Regional Conference on Money and Politics. Activists from around the South were there to share ideas, discuss strategy, and voice criticism. I got a chance to speak with Nick Neihardt. He's the national field organizer for Public Campaign. That's a new group that's based in Washington, D.C., that advocates public financing of elections. Since 1992, Nick Neihardt has directed a six-state campaign finance research and public education program for the Northeast Citizen Action Resource Center, known as NECARC, based in Connecticut, but now has joined Public Campaign in their massive effort to push for public spending on campaigns in this country. And I started off by asking Nick Neihardt just to explain what public campaign is and what public financing of elections looks like.
Public campaign, I think, would like to see a campaign finance system in which money counted for far less. We think one of the best ways to do that is clean money campaign finance reform. Under clean money campaign reform, candidates who agree to take no private money and agree to spending limits would receive money from a publicly financed citizens fund.
What would qualify them exactly? Just not taking any private money?
There's a first step, actually two first steps. First, candidates would have to meet the ballot access standards in their state or their district to get on the ballot, and then they would have to demonstrate broad public support by collecting a large number of small contributions, say $5 contributions, from citizens within their district.
Why have to get that money? Why not just signatures?
I think the folks who have looked at this have felt signatures were a little too easy to get to entitle someone to public money, and you wanted a threshold that was a bit higher. And yet they didn't want big money to set the threshold as it does now for being a serious candidate. So the idea was a size of contribution that most candidates could afford, and they thought $5 made the most sense. Most people could afford that, though not everybody.
Explain what you mean by right now big money determines someone getting matching funds.
If you look at the presidential level, I think last time around people said to be a serious candidate, you got to raise $20 million. I mean, I think there they were saying there's a wealth primary. In order to pass the wealth primary and be able to run in the big election, the general election or the party primaries, you got to win the wealth primary. And when you have to collect $20 million to be considered a real candidate, I think that's what we're talking about when we say big money.
Where did this idea of wealth primary come from?
I'm not sure who first coined the term, but the two people who I think have made it most famous are two lawyers, John Boniface and Jamie Raskin, who have essentially said that our current campaign finance system ought to be unconstitutional because it does not afford equal access to protection under the law, in that regular folks who can't afford $1,000 contributions don't have access to the political system in the same way that people who can give the big money. And in effect, you have a wealth primary where candidates can't really contest for office unless they have serious financial backing, and that's unfair.
How do you entice a candidate to go for the public financing scheme here, since there's going to be a set limit of how much money they can get, and if their opponent takes private money, they can go well beyond them?
That's a good question. I think there are two answers. First, the level of public funding has to be sufficiently high that the candidate gets a good start and has enough to run a competitive race. If the other candidate doesn't take that arrangement, says, no, I don't want to run a level playing field, I want to beat you with private money, you've got to give the clean money candidate some protection. We think the best way to do that is with matching money. So let's say the level for a state rep in a certain state is $10,000, and that's the nominal amount. If the private money candidate says, no, I'm going to raise $15,000, then you got to take the original $10,000 that the clean money candidate gets and add another $5,000 to that. If they say, well, I'll up that, I'll spend $20,000, then you got to protect the clean money candidate even further. Obviously, at some point, you need to set some limit so it's not open-ended. But I think what we've seen is that it doesn't take an infinite amount of money to get the word out in the district. It just takes enough money to be in the same ballpark with your opponent. And I think that's what you need the clean money system to guarantee, to make it enticing and fair for candidates.
And how do you answer charges like come up in Florida that has partial public funding, although there is now an effort to get a constitutional amendment to prevent all future public financing, but charges there that are thrown around and in other places where they say all this is welfare for politicians?
I don't think most people see it that way. In fact, when we've asked folks, I mean, right now I think you have sort of corporate welfare for politicians. Instead, they're taking huge amounts of private money and repaying those people with legislative policies that favor those givers. So this is sort of the alternative. I think there is a problem, though, under the partial public financing model, such as you have in Florida or you have at the presidential level, where essentially, because there's still so much private money in there, you leave politicians in the position of taking the public money, but then still having to go on bended knee, hat in hand, to private money sources. So I don't think you get much effect out of many of the partial systems. I think it helps in certain races and certain times, but in other cases, you've really just established a matching fund for wealthy private donors.
What is the record of states right now around the issue of public financing?
There are about 23 states that have some form of public resources, either tax credits or some kind of public financing at the candidate or party level. So some use of public financing we see all around, but no one has, except Maine, which in a voter referendum in 1996 passed a new law for clean money campaign reform. No one has gone all the way and say we want to give candidates the option so they don't have to take private money from wealthy contributors in order to stand a fair chance of getting elected. On the other hand, at the state level, there's considerable openness to this. I think if you want to take on big money interests and change the system, Washington is the last place you're going to find success. I think the state situations are much more accessible for ordinary people to make change. And in fact, there are about 15 states right now where organizers are putting together plans to try and win clean money campaign finance reform in their states in the next several years. There are about a half dozen states that are looking at possible clean money referenda next year, 1998. And there are several other states that are advancing it legislatively. In New England, right near Maine, you have Vermont that is likely to pass a clean money campaign reform bill in its legislature sometime later this May. So we may have another state this year. Out west, you have states like Washington and Idaho that are looking at the potential of a referendum. In the southwest, there's Arizona. In the middle of the country, you have Michigan and Missouri that are also thinking about going to referendum this coming year. And then also for 1998, New York City. There are activists there looking at a full clean money campaign finance reform referendum, and also activists in Massachusetts looking at the same thing. So you see state after state trying to find an alternative and figuring that while we can't make changes right now at the federal level, this sweeping, we can win them in the states and move from there eventually to Washington.
You're using the term clean money. Do you use the term public financing?
I think the term public financing is confusing in a couple ways. One, it only refers to one aspect of the whole program. We're not throwing money at candidates. In fact, we're only allowing people to get the money once they've shown support in the district and said goodbye to private money and also agreed to spending limits. So that's a difference. There are many public financing schemes that don't require the candidates to take those actions. So we want to separate ourselves from those kinds of actions. I think also when people think public financing, the people that do associate it with any kind of current system associate it with the presidential system, which has candidates spending years, several years, courting $1,000 donors, the very wealthiest people in America, and the folks that can put 500 of those people in a room. And that's not what what we mean by the changes we want to see. And so we talk about clean money campaign reform because we want to get rid of the vested interest economic money, and because it doesn't refer to public financing, the systems that we've seen around this country. We're really talking about something different.
There's an anti-tax climate in this country. So how do you get away from people equating clean campaigns with increased taxes?
Well, the main model required so little funding that no tax increase was necessitated. They actually asked that voters check off if they want a small portion of their state income tax to go into the special fund. They also transferred some money from the administrative budgets of the executive and legislative branches into this clean money fund. And the amount, $5 per taxpayer, is generally 0.1% of the state budget, and there are budget fluctuations like that in state budgets all the time. In Connecticut, for instance, that's looking at it this year, the size of the estimated surplus is about $150 million. This program would cost $8 or $10 million that they're talking about. So you're not necessarily talking about either budget cuts or tax increases. As someone said at this conference we're at today, the money you're talking about is budget dust. These just don't have a big impact on tax rates or state budgets. It's that kind of size of money, small percent of the state budgets. On the other hand, I do think you want to be careful about using taxpayers' money, and that's why we're not handing this money out. We don't think the money should be handed out willy-nilly to any candidate who comes along. We want to save it for candidates who are willing to make the change, go for a new system, and who will say no to the private money and say yes to spending limits.
Do you think there would be a lot of corporate welfare done away with if people weren't beholden to the corporations when they run?
I think it's awful hard to expect state legislatures or a Congress that owe their seats to the people who are up there demanding special favors to never give those folks any special favors. It just sort of defies reason to think you're going to get fair, balanced judgments when people are that dependent on corporate money to run their elections. So I think the reverse is true. I think we got a fighting chance. You still have the huge core of lobbyists in the state houses and Congress, but at least you'll have candidates who don't depend on those same people for their money to make honest decisions. You got a chance, a fighting chance, to get rid of some of that corporate welfare. And it's another good point. One of the conservative Republicans on the Hill estimated that there's about $11 billion he'd like to see gotten rid of in corporate welfare. Well, the estimate of what it would cost to take clean money campaign reform to the U.S. Senate would be about $500 million a year. So you could cut just a small percent of what even conservative Republicans consider corporate pork out of the budget, and you'd have enough money to fund something like this.
So you could actually be saving taxpayers' money.
Yes. I mean, I think we won't it's hard to prove that in advance, but certainly you won't have congresspeople who have such a strong incentive to make such ridiculous decisions about the nation's priorities.
We're talking to Nick Neihardt, who's the national field organizer of this new organization called Public Campaign. What is your view of the McCain-Feingold bill? What is it, first of all? Because, I think campaign finance is some of the most complicated stuff going, and what's Public Campaign's view of it?
It's basically a system that's before Congress and the Senate right now, or the Senate right now, but there's a similar bill in Congress that would do a variety of things. It would set some voluntary limits, give people who abide by those some free resources. On the whole, though, I think even if you, and it would ban soft money, that's actually one of the very best things about it. But if McCain-Feingold passed as it was written tomorrow and they got everything, which it probably won't happen, there'll be some compromised version or nothing at all passing. If it all passed tomorrow, you'd still have the specter of candidates having to go to special interests to fund their and wealthy people to fund their campaigns instead of to ordinary voters. It would decrease that somewhat, but that would still be a major dynamic of the campaign. So win or lose, we need to go beyond that and fight for the long term for a system where money is not the currency of democracy anymore.
You not only have enemies in the Republican Party, of course, that are against this, but the Democratic Party, too. It's how they both get to where they are.
I know that people have said it's the incumbent-crats who are the people who are against serious campaign finance reform. I think that's true. I think that's why it's going to be hard to win in Washington anytime soon. The further away you get from sort of centers of political power, the more support you find for genuine reform. Even within the political parties, you find at the grassroots level, where ordinary people who belong to their town committee, Republican or Democrat, are feeling shut out of the process again, and that their role as a party activist is now much less important because it's the party funder who gets courted by the party elite and the candidates. So, you know, when we lump party people all together, I think there's a difference between rank-and-file party people and the people at the very top. Certainly the incumbents and their chief fundraisers most of their funders are the people who will be the last folks to come around. But I think everybody else we can win to our side.
We're talking to Nick Neihardt, the national field organizer for the New Group Public Campaign. When we come back, we'll ask him about some of the, well, tricky questions involved with large foundations pouring millions into a movement that grassroots organizations know if they want to get money, they should redirect themselves a bit. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back in 60 seconds. This is Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman as we continue our discussion with Nick Neihardt. I got a chance to speak to him this weekend when I went down to the Highlander Center just outside Knoxville, Tennessee, where Southern groups had gathered to talk about campaign finance reform efforts. Nick Neihardt is the national field organizer for Public Campaign. Now let me ask you a few tricky questions about Public Campaign and the funding. Ellen Miller, a few weeks ago, had a big news conference announcing the organization. We've had Ellen on a lot from her tenure at the Center for Responsive Politics, talking about, you know, how much money was spent during the elections. But there's something interesting happening here. You have Public Campaign now getting something like $9 million from foundations like the Schuman Foundation, the J. Roderick MacArthur Foundation, the Open Society Institute, that's Soros' foundation, all of these foundations deciding to coordinate their money to be very aggressive in shaping where their funding goes as opposed to passive giving, and deciding to sort of make a big effort here, a big splash at the national and state level on campaign finance. So in a sense, this is, since foundation money comes from corporations, this is sort of a big corporate effort too.
It is, in a way. I think one of the differences is that unlike corporate giving to a cause or to politics, there's not a direct payback for the Soros Institute or the Schuman Foundation. They will not reap millions of dollars in profits the way a company does when it gives money to congressional candidates or something. So I think that's a big difference. They don't get something like that back. I do think, though, that the kind of money they're talking about is actually small when you compare it to what campaign reformers are up against. When you want to take the $1.6 billion industry that is the campaign financing industry that you have right now and get rid of most of it, that's a huge battle to take on with a couple million a year for a national organization and additional money that does in 50 states. So I think, in fact, reformers are going to need to raise more money at the state level, at the regional level, and at the national level to win eventually. But I think increasingly philanthropic funders are feeling like many of the common sense programs that their grantees are pursuing don't get a fair shake in politics. And so increasingly they're looking at this, worried that democracy itself is at stake, and being willing to give money to restore fair civic participation in the country, which is impossible without some measure of campaign finance reform. I also think that frankly, it's going to have to be small donors and also political givers. They're going to have to decide to support a change in our system. And without that, we're not going to see serious changes. We're not going to, through a nickel and dime movement, eliminate the, like I said, the $1.6 billion campaign finance industry. I think it's going to take some money to fight that, far less than what they have, because we have lots of people on our side. But it is going to take a serious effort. And I think in Washington, frankly, for national organizations, $2 to $2.5 million a year doesn't quite make you a major player. I still think in Washington terms, that's pretty grassroots.
Maybe compared to the other side, it's not a lot of money. But compared to what has been given to a lot of these grassroots organizations, of course, it's a tremendous amount of money. And what I've seen over the last months is that a lot of groups that weren't taking on the issue of campaign finance reform are being told they got to take it on or they're not going to get funding, in a shift in focus on funding. So it's really changing the nature of some grassroots organizations, or grassroots organizations see that there's a pot of money out there for this. And so they're going to start to shift their priorities to get some of this money.
I haven't heard of organizations being told they can't have money unless they do campaign finance reform. I do think that as money becomes available where it wasn't before, groups that could not think of the possibility of contesting that issue begin to think of contesting it and begin to think, what could we do on this issue if we had some money to fight on it? Because I think there hasn't been that money available in the past, so people don't ask for the money, they don't design the programs, and they don't go for it. I think, unfortunately, a lot of it, grassroots issue activism has to rely on the generosity of others in order, you know, foundations or people who made lots of money, in order to proceed in what they want. And I think there is sort of a sometimes a fickleness to that kind of funding, but people want to take advantage of it when it's there. So I think there are a lot more people who are considering the possibility of campaign finance reform work that didn't before, and that's a good thing. I think more people will be doing it. Unfortunately, you know, there won't be as much money as everybody wants to do the job, and so I think that's going to take a lot of cooperation among different kinds of groups at the regional level, at the national level, at the state level, and even at the local level to figure out how we can fit this all together in order to win some real change.
Another tricky issue that seems to be raised by this is you have the foundations giving money and putting a lot of money now into campaign finance reform, and you have them now giving money, for example, to Public Campaign, which then becomes a re-granting organization. So you have Ellen Miller in charge of this many million dollars, and she then will decide which groups should get money and which groups shouldn't. And it seems to me that squelches debate around the whole issue of Public Campaign, because there's all different ways to do public financing. But if people attack Public Campaign, they fear that they won't be the ones that get money. And so it's definitely narrowing the debate around an issue that should have more debate now than ever.
Let me say a couple things on that. One is there is far more money out there that's being given to campaign finance reform work than Public Campaign holds sway over. We have some money to be part of it, to have to re-grant, but it's a very small percent of what's being given nationally for far-reaching campaign finance reform. And there are other proposals besides clean money campaign reform. On the other hand, I think that's what you say is a good point. People may be less willing to speak honestly to us about what they think needs to be done or not be done, and feel like to agree they've got to say the right things or get the money. I think there's a flip side to that too, which is that Public Campaign can't possibly succeed unless state-based organizations want to work on this issue and want to work with us. We don't have legs on the ground unless the existing projects that are doing great work want to work with us. So I think there's power on both sides of this equation. What's more, there are some long-standing relationships here. When Ellen was at the Center for Responsive Politics, she did a lot of work with state groups that got them off the ground in terms of analyzing how the flow of campaign money affected the issues they were working on. And I think there's a history of good relationships. I myself come out of state work in Connecticut and around New England, and the work we did was helped immeasurably by Ellen, the people at the Center for Responsive Politics. And I think that set of good relationships can continue. I think, ironically, in some ways, having more money puts strains on those relationships because all of a sudden there is stuff to fight over that, frankly, there didn't used to be to fight over. So I think it's up to both sides to realize that we have some opportunities here. They only are going to work if we can all work together.
We're not only talking about the large foundations putting their money now into public campaign and campaign financing issues in general, but then you have this effort of foundations trying to get other foundations on board to funnel their money into campaign financing. So that's, I think, the place where I see the money coming away from other issues, that these groups that have not given traditionally to campaign finance issues, and even these foundations more and more being pushed by the foundation world to get on this bandwagon.
I think that's true. I think that there is an effort by some of the groups that have given to us to encourage other foundations to give more money in this area. On the other hand, there are many kinds of organizations that also receive money from those foundations that want to be able to add a money in politics component to their work. So I'm not sure that it doesn't just take away from one kind of work to another. It enhances the work that people are trying to get done. And the reason so many activists have begun to turn to this issue is they see this as a real block to what the issues they want to win on. And that, you know, with the environmental issues, perhaps that you can get grassroots support on your side. You can go and lobby as much as you want at the state capitol or in Congress, and you can try and run candidates for office, but in the end, the polluting companies are investing their money in politics and having it pay off in policy, and people can't seem to win doing a lot of the other kinds of organizing. So I think having foundations sort of shift their priorities to incorporate that factor into the work they want to see done is actually a positive thing.
Last question is that, I guess, while campaign finance is a critical issue, one thing I see here at Highlander at this meeting is that here we are in the South, it's all Southern groups in a lot of areas that are majority black, but you have a majority white gathering here. And I don't think that's a coincidence, because I think campaign finance activism is a largely white issue. It's once removed from the basic issues or sort of safety net issues of helping people directly on the ground. And so then I don't know where the foundation was money was going before, but it's even more now concentrated, it seems to me, in white groups.
I'm not sure that the foundations are pulling money out of communities of color into this issue at all. But I do think in order to win on this issue, it has to really broaden and diversify. Apart from the people who worked on it historically, I think this has been very much a sort of white middle-class issue through the years, but I think as the effects of big money in politics sort of ripple out through all kinds of other communities, it's up to the people who are now working on the issue to figure out ways to talk in those communities so that this issue becomes a piece of the work, not a central or overriding piece of the work, but there begins to be an analysis that says when there's an agenda of contributors that reflects their particular economic interests, which are far different from that of working-class families or people in poor communities, that we're going to see legislatures and Congress accepting those agendas and making them their own and making them into law. I think drawing that connection, figuring out organizing ways to do that is something that the people of this conference are going to be focusing on. I think you've heard it here. People have said you need to make this issue relevant. It's a power issue, not a process issue, but we need to start talking about it that way.
If people want to get in touch with Public Campaign, do you have a phone number and also a website? A website where they can just find out what you're doing, but also that has that vital information, and that is what money their politicians are receiving.
That's right. You can call us at area code 202-293-0222. You can check us out on our website at www.publiccampaign.org. That's public campaign with as one word with one C. And the most entertaining thing on the website, I think, is a money meter that meters the $12 a second that are flowing from wealthy contributors into congressional campaign coffers every second to make up the hundreds of millions of dollars a year that the candidates have to take in under our current system. So it's sort of like the the New Year's thermometer at Times Square or something like that, except this goes up and counts hundreds of millions of dollars, and it happens live while you're watching on the website. So it's a little bit of entertainment along with the hard facts.
It's like the debt clock in New York, but it's sort of a democracy debt clock.
That's right. And, you know, you get into the website, you peruse around for a little bit, and you look back, and it's gone up thousands of dollars just in those 20 seconds or something.
What's that phone number again for the internet illiterates?
The phone number is 202-293-0222.
And that's Nick Neihardt, National Field Organizer for Public Campaign based in Washington, D.C. I spoke with him this weekend at the Highlander Center outside of Knoxville, Tennessee, where Southern groups had gathered to talk about the issue of campaign finance reform. The Highlander Center was founded in 1932 by Miles Horton and Don West in Tennessee as an adult education center. It was a training center for Southern labor and farmers union members, as a meeting place for black and white civil rights workers, and a resource for activists nationwide. You may or may not know that it was Rosa Parks who went there just before she sat down on the front of the bus. She, too, was trained as an activist at the Highlander Center. Well, at the Highlander Center, one of the people I got a chance to talk to this weekend was Charlotte Pritt, coal miner's daughter who ran an insurgent campaign for governor last year in West Virginia on the Democratic ticket, a former state delegate and senator with a long track record of successful advocacy on women's issues. Charlotte Pritt ran a strong underdog campaign talking about the need for business, especially coal companies, to pay their fair share. She also highlighted the needs of West Virginia's families for education, health care, and a decent standard of living. Pritt was opposed by Republican Cecil Underwood, who outspent her with contributions pouring in from the Republican Party and business interests. She was attacked as a pro-abortion, anti-gun, anti-death penalty extremist. Pritt nearly won a historic upset victory last November, but fell short by only 35,000 votes. It was about 6% of the votes that she lost by. Many observers, however, say that Pritt fell victim to not only a high-tech, mean-spirited campaign by her opponent, but to old-style ballot rigging, including the practice of paying black voters to stay home from the polls. I started by asking Charlotte Pritt why she thinks she lost.
Well, I think there were several factors that were involved in why there were many power groups who were concerned. You know, I came from a labor background. My father was a United Mine worker. I was a member of AFT and WVEA, NEA.
You were a teacher?
Yes, I was a classroom teacher and have taught both in public schools and at the university, and was drafted to run for governor in 92 by several people, the environmental group and progressives throughout the state, who had said, why are we always supporting the wrong person and trying to get someone to do the right thing? Why don't we just get out there and get behind the person who's been showing and doing the right thing for all these years? So I was a known quantity, and I think that we did so well in 92. We came within 8 points of winning, and we only were out there for 6 weeks and had $125,000 with an all-volunteer staff, and we were up against an incumbent multimillionaire who outspent me 10 to 1.
Who was that?
That was Gaston Caperton. And we had done so well that in 96 they were concerned and they were ready. And I think that what was most disturbing for me as someone who comes from a communications background, English, speech, and journalism was my major in college, and taught that both in the high school and in the college level, was to see how money and media has been used against progressive candidates who traditionally reflect the populace, the people. And to see the banking association go after me because I was the sponsor of the Community Reinvestment Act to try to get banks to put more of the money we put in the banks available to make it available to other people in their area for school loans and mortgages and small businesses. To see the medical association go after me because I'm a firm believer in having the medical profession open itself and to allowing more people to have alternative health care. We call it traditional health care in West Virginia because in West Virginia people were doing herbal medicines and energy healings long before anybody knew what Reiki healing was or heard about, you know, some of the pharmaceuticals. So being a candidate that wanted to allow people to have a voice, whether it was choices in health care or choice about your reproductive rights or parenthood, or whether it was making sure you had the right to know about the safety or lack of safety in the workplace or the chemicals that you were working with, just making sure that basic rights were being met, that our civil rights were being met, that people weren't being discriminated against because of their gender or their race or their preferences. Just doing what you thought was the American democratic thing to do. And so it was amazing to see that the timber industry and the mining industry, internationals, were involved in the campaign in this state. It was almost flattering in some respects to see who my enemies were. You know, they were the corporate rulers and power brokers throughout not only the state and the country, but throughout the world when you get into mining and timbering.
You mentioned reproductive rights, and you have a very colorful history on reproductive rights when it comes to the state legislature. You served in both the Assembly and the Senate. Can you talk about the bills you introduced?
Oh, yes. And there was quite a bit of misunderstanding about those, too, because what had happened is that we only had a couple. There were only two of us on the Health and Human Resources Committee that were choice. And although I would choose to have my child if I were to get pregnant, I think it's such a personal thing. It's between a woman and God. And if you believe in God, then you realize that those are decisions that people have to make themselves. And if you don't, then you don't have to worry about that. But it was interesting to see that the kinds of legislation that was coming through that we saw, forcing a woman to get her boyfriend's permission before she could choose to have an abortion, or all kinds of just outrageous information and legislation that was going through. So we just simply asked the bill drafters to draft bills that would mirror the legislation that was being introduced. For example, one of the bills happened to be a bill that said that if a man is going to have to have a vasectomy, then he must get permission of his girlfriend or his wife. And so it was that kind of bringing to focus how narrow the discussion had become on reproductive rights. And the men would, and then one of them said, if you are in arrears with your child support payment for more than a year, then you'd have to have involuntary sterilization. Of course, now that was ridiculous, and I didn't want that to happen by any stretch of the imagination. But what it did is it brought to light how ridiculous these forced bills were as far as what was happening with individual women.
Charlotte Pritt, former West Virginia state senator for 8 years, who ran on the Democratic ticket for governor this past November. We'll be back with her in 60 seconds. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman as we continue our conversation with Charlotte Pritt, the former West Virginia Democratic gubernatorial candidate who came within 6 percentage points of winning the governorship this past November. I asked her how the media of West Virginia dealt with her campaign.
The media in West Virginia is unfortunately reflecting what we're seeing nationwide, and that's more and more Republicans are buying up the media. Every newspaper in the state now, West Virginia, which used to be considered as a pretty Democratic state, is owned by Republicans, owned or controlled by Republicans. Every daily newspaper in the state is. The only statewide radio station, talk show, and really statewide we have limited people involved, is owned by Republicans. They carry these right-wing groups on the station. Television station with the widest distribution, owned by Republicans. So they're controlling the media. And I had terrible difficulty in my race of getting fair coverage, especially in the newspapers, but also to a certain degree in the debates. My opponent would not debate on. We usually have a televised debate by public television. The League of Women Voters handled that. He refused to. So the Broadcasting Association, which owned by and controlled by Republicans, had the debates, and they didn't use the typical format. So it was unbelievable the kinds of outrageous departures from what should be happening.
You ran against Republican Cecil Underwood, who's now the governor of West Virginia. How much did he spend? How did it compare to what you spent?
I spent about $1 million in a little over $1 million in the general election, and he spent nearly $2 million. I think it was about $1.5 million. But he also had the National Republican Senatorial Committee came in and used senatorial congressional money in my gubernatorial race and used it against me. And they did incredibly negative ads with outrageous statements that were completely misinformation, unfounded. And the television stations ran them anyway.
What did they say?
Oh, they were saying things that I was trying to encourage first graders to learn how to. I was mandating that first graders learn how to use condoms, which is absolutely it's ludicrous. I don't even think it's biologically possible to do that. And outrageous things of that nature. So it's been really interesting to see how far out of line the communications the FCC has gotten, in the sense they should be able to stop that kind of thing from going on, especially during campaigns, and that we should have laws that would prohibit that.
How supportive were the Democrats of your campaign? For example, West Virginia Senator Robert Byrd.
Senator Byrd did not support me. And I thought that was most unfortunate, but I think it probably speaks to how conservative he actually is. He was a member of the Ku Klux Klan at one time, and I think he's gotten over that. But I was really surprised that he did not help me more, because he was a person who did not grow up with much money. My father was a coal miner. We both were people who came from poverty-stricken backgrounds. But I guess I think the gender was a big factor. Also, he wanted to put a highway through West Virginia. I was saying I support infrastructure, but I wanted to make sure that what we did was environmentally and historically and culturally sensitive and sound. I think he wanted someone who was simply going to do whatever that he asked them to do. So I was very disappointed. But I think what's happening in West Virginia is that Senator Rockefeller did support me a great deal. President Clinton did support me, and I think that reflects that there is a move in the party. There is the old guard that is not very supportive of women. I do believe that the president and Senator Rockefeller are supportive of women and did want to help. The National Democratic Party, however, had promised through the coordinated campaign to send in $200,000. I understand they sent nearly $1 million to Steve Beshear in Kentucky, who was 18 percentage points behind. I was in a dead heat race. And they only sent in $33,000 for the coordinated campaign, or $39,000. So they reneged on $170,000. They sent it to other races. In my race, it would have made me governor of West Virginia if the Democrats had followed through what they had promised they would do. So we did see, I think, from the national level, some sexism in the funding. I understand from talking to other women candidates who had close races that the money went to men candidates rather than to women candidates. And in our races, we could have won with the money. In their races, they were so far behind that they really couldn't have. So we need to work on that and making sure that the fundraisers and the people at the head of the National Democratic Committee, we have women in decision-making positions about where the money is going to be funneled and how it's going to be spent.
We're talking to Charlotte Pritt, and she was the Democratic candidate for governor of West Virginia in a very close race. She lost this past November. Now, Charlotte, at the Highlander Center, you were giving a talk just over the weekend, and you said that there was some hanky-panky going on, basically, in the elections that you ran in. We know about Ed Rollins in New Jersey boasting that he paid black ministers to keep his congregants home in the race that Christine Todd Whitman won for governor of New Jersey. You said that the same kind of business was going on in West Virginia.
We know of in 1992 when I had run, and we had Norman Ferguson was also running for the House of Delegates, and part of the black district was also in my district and his district. And with a black man running who had wonderful credentials, he was IBEW, he was the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers. Politics was wonderful. He was a progressive candidate who was truly concerned about what was happening to the black community as well as to working men and women all throughout the state. Would have been a wonderful delegate. We found out that in the district I'd had traditional support from the black community because I've been a very strong civil rights and human rights proponent in the House and in the Senate. And I'd very, very much, when I'd run for the House and the Senate, had always had good turnouts in those particular precincts. In the 1992 election, however, we were counting on a great, Norm and I both, for great percentage coming out of that district. And we looked at, there may have been 400-some voters in that particular precinct, and it was like 30 may have voted. It was incredible. And we started asking around, and we heard that they were paid to stay home.
This was 1992?
1992, that they were paid to stay home. So when we saw it happening in New Jersey, we thought, well, they did the same thing to us in West Virginia. And what we find with the right is that they use the same techniques from state to state, whether it's smearing a real good candidate, progressive candidate, someone who's actually there fighting for ethics and government. They use the same things against women. They'll say they're lesbian or they're whores, whichever works. They slept their way to the top. And they will use the same kind of smear tactics. They'll go into, if it's a progressive that's backed by the labor community, they'll try to bring in the death penalty, or the NRA will come in to try to separate the vote there. If it's someone who's done a lot of social justice work on issues of hunger and homeless issues and civil rights issues, they'll try to go to the churches and say this person's for choice, they're baby killers, they're immoral, they believe in homosexuality, and whatever it is that they can think of that will divide and bring a wedge into a base that is most affected by having good candidates there, progressive, liberal candidates there working. It's very heartbreaking to see that poor religious people, labor people, turn away from the candidates who are their strongest and best supporters. They turn away from their own self-interest on emotional issues that have been skewed by the Republican Party infiltrating the very base and the very people who need progressive liberal Democratic candidates.
Can you prove that this happened?
Well, we did have, we asked someone if they would testify, and they were on welfare, and they were afraid that their welfare would be challenged or they would be, that the state would have done something to them. And it's very likely that they would have, and they could have, because what we found in the race in 92, that a lot of my county coordinators and my district coordinators, the state did audits if they had businesses or did audits if they were individuals. So nearly, you would have, that percentage of people who were my key people, supporters in the campaign who were audited by the state tax department was unbelievable. So they have ways of letting you know that you don't get out of line without paying the penalty.
So here we are 6 months or so later. It must have been incredibly grueling, especially because it was so close at the end, 5 percentage points away, that you lost the West Virginia governorship by. First, do you plan to run again, and what lessons have you learned?
Well, I think working deeper and stronger with the base and getting our base more educated and letting them know how extremely important it is for them not to become apathetic, but to be more and more empowered and more determined by the shenanigans that we see. Also to do more coalition building and connecting with people in different states about what the radical right is doing to the good progressive candidates that are so much needed. Those are the things that building the base, like we are here at Highlander, and talking about what we can do to get money out of politics in the sense of making it manageable so that we don't have international coal companies and international timber companies coming in and funding the candidates who are going to continue the raping and pillaging of states like West Virginia, that we have citizens who can determine their own future by being able to finance candidates or to support candidates through grassroots work. I think that we need to have campaign spending limits, and I personally am dedicating a great deal of my time to insisting that the Supreme Court be more honorable in recusing themselves. They're appointed by people who run the most expensive campaigns in the world and confirmed by senators who run the second most expensive campaigns in the world. They're a product of this very destructive democracy for sale process that we see right now. And the American public does want campaign spending limits, so I think that what we need to do is put it on the ballot, and we need to vote the campaign spending limits into place with full disclosure. Anything short of that, I think, is band-aiding, and I know that people have good intentions. They're trying to find ways in which we can address this issue. But I think the American public must be outraged, and they must continue to insist, like we did in the civil rights movement. We insist on fairness by saying we insist that the Supreme Court interpret the Constitution in the way in which it was intended so that each of us has an equal opportunity, and that's by making sure that there's a limit on how much can be spent on a particular campaign. So I am going to be continuing to work to make sure that the Supreme Court and the judicial system is fair to the public.
We've been talking with Charlotte Pritt, who is the West Virginia gubernatorial candidate who ran this past November for governor. You're listening to Democracy Now! Again, she was speaking at a weekend event at the Highlander Center outside of Knoxville, Tennessee. The Highlander Center, which has long trained activists in labor, as well as political activists, particularly active in the civil rights movement of the South. And in the next few weeks, we'll be bringing you more on the Highlander Center, which is just about to celebrate its 65th anniversary. But while we have this minute, I just wanted to read some email that we got. We got an email from some people in Pennsylvania. Pacifica listeners offering to bail out Temple Radio pledge drive if their banned show, Democracy Now!, is reinstated. Last month, radio fans called in pledges to Temple Radio station WRTI, provided that it reinstate Democracy Now! According to on-air announcers, WRTI's fund drive has been doing poorly, and the station may have to be sold if enough money wasn't raised. The action was organized by Storming the Temple, a group of Pacifica listeners organized to convince Temple University to reverse its decision to censor Pacifica programming. Pacifica Network programming had been so popular that it had broken fundraising records for WRTI. Storming the Temple's Dylan Wren said that the group is just beginning its campaign to protect freedom of the press from cowardly officials like Temple University officials. Storming the Temple organized listeners to call the WRTI pledge line and have their addresses and pledges taken down, but then callers said they wouldn't be able to send in checks until WRTI restored Democracy Now! Miriam Budnick, a Storming the Temple member, said that WRTI volunteers reported they had received a lot of pledges contingent on bringing back Pacifica programming. We'll continue to see what happens. Well, Democracy Now! Is produced by Dan Coughlin. Our engineer and assistant producer is Errol Maitland. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. If you'd like to send us email, you can send it at democracy@pacifica.org. That's democracy@pacifica.org. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!